Welcome to the Unconventional Dyad Podcast, where psychology and psychoanalysis meet social justice, feminism, politics, climate change, critical theory, graduate student mental health, and the arts.
Your hosts are Carly and Laura, two graduate students and friends committed to bridging the gap between the field of psychology, social issues, and society.
Thank you for joining us.
Hello, everyone, and thank you for tuning in to part two of our two-part series with Carlos Padron. If you did not get a chance to listen to part one of this series, I would recommend listening to episode number 31st as we continue the conversation in this episode. We continue discussing the ethics of care within psychoanalysis, the radical use of silence, and we begin to discuss the question of, is there an aim in psychoanalysis? Can our patients truly get better and find truth if we have an aim? We hope you enjoy the episode.
Change can be very scary. Very, very scary. Because we just, remember, all this suffering is because there's a bunch of conflicts in my mind that's producing, let's say, the procrastination, but there's also a lot of defenses at play that are keeping me from feeling a worse kind of suffering, right? So the neurotic suffering is better than some other suffering that I'm trying to avoid by procrastinating. That's the irony of it, right? This suffering is better, the suffering of the procrastination, than some other suffering that I fear, or some other anxiety, right? So I stay with what's familiar. So that's one form of suffering. The other form of suffering is when things become unfamiliar to me, I think. And I think that's where free associative praxis, and I call it a praxis, purposely, it's a form of praxis to kind of like relate it to other forms of praxis, like political practice, social activism. It's a form of praxis. It's when it's a way of this thing that's frozen and stuck, but that's familiar, it starts to get, you know, it gets unfrozen somehow, and we become estranged from ourselves. We introduce a level of unfamiliarity in our lives. When patients, they start speaking about something, they say, I don't know what the hell I'm saying, or why did I say this? Or I don't know where this is coming from. Something happens and they're all of a sudden they become strangers to themselves. And that can be very scary. And that can produce another form of suffering, right? I think that's the analytic process. I think we have to go through that part, that suffering, which means becoming strangers to ourselves again. We can't liberate ourselves from these things that we do all the time and make us feel suffer without tolerating becoming strangers to ourselves in some way or another, I think. But that takes time. It can be done over, you know, 2 weeks, 3 weeks, 4 weeks. It takes a lot of time. A lot of time, you see? So I don't know. And again, the system, the mental health system, doesn't help clinicians to take their time or patients to take their time. You know, everybody's in a rush, or clinicians are. I think we talked about it. There's the problem with the insurances. Are they going to pay? Not going to pay? How long is the treatment going to last? That's one issue, right? Or we live in a super litigious country, one of the most litigious in the world, where people sue each other all the time for everything. So health practitioners, including mental health practitioners, suffer from that, right? Again, I'm talking about a system that doesn't provide a structure of care right, of security. So the clinicians sometimes, instead of doing what they should do, which might be take more time, which might be maybe see the person more often, instead of hospitalizing them, for example. You know, the Bolus book, Catch Them Before They Fall, is about that. People who are on the verge of a breakdown, not necessarily a psychotic breakdown, and Bolus will increase frequency not to only to 5 times a week, but he'll see patients twice a day. Or sometimes he'll see people during 4 days from 9 to 6. You know, but he says that that's possible in England where he lives because things are much more flexible, right? And people are less scared, are more flexible. People are less scared that the patient is going to sue them or whatever. Here, this kind of care, right? It's about care, is less possible. It's only either you're hospitalized or then at the office. You're many times scared to do what you think you should do. You act, and there's papers, literature on this, not only mental health practitioners, but also medical doctors. I've had terrible experiences with medical doctors here in the US who are, you know, we have the experience. You go, they're writing their notes, because of course they're overworked, so they have to be writing it as they're seeing you because they can't do it afterwards. But they're not really seeing you at the eyes. They don't touch you anymore in the body because there happened something. They don't have a clinical opinion of what's going on. This holistic idea of how, you know, the pain in your back might be related to this or to that. They'll just send you to a bunch of specialists and make you take all these exams, right? And then it's like the wholeness of you as a person and as a body is split and divided in a Frankensteinian way into multiple specialties. And I've had seen patients, especially the poor patients who have, you know, who can't afford a good, you know, a good PCP or a good internist. They'll have all these, you know, been to all these doctors. And then nobody who sits with them and makes sense out of everything. Mm-hmm. So they're taking 50 medications. And when I tell them, you have to go to a good PCP, in that case, I will tell them. I mean, I think that it's my responsibility for care in that case to tell them, look, do this. And then they find somebody. And instead of taking 50 medications, it was only 5. They were taking 2 for the same thing. So you see, mm-hmm. It's this fragmentation that I think it's also proper to the society, capitalist society that we live in, that favors not only atomization, social atomization, but also or social fragmentation, but also fragments the body and the mind of people. So I think that psychoanalysis through this stillness, right? This contemplative stillness that slows things down and sees people not just as a bunch of symptoms, but as a whole person, and that respects that which the patient is bringing, works counter to all of this in many ways. It's the very opposite in many, in very, very important ways. It's the this form of what I'm calling, you know, an ethics of care. I'm calling it, broadly speaking, as you know, the term comes from Carol Gilligan, the feminist. I think the first, it was in A Different Voice, in 1982 book that she started to write about an ethics of care. And it's a whole, but, you know, it's related where, you know, it's an ethics more related to relationships, to feeling, to empathy, compassion, and less an ethics based on principles and abstract ideas, etc., right? So again, I have that in mind, but also I'm talking about it in a more loose way, not in that strict way in which she talks about it. It's the very opposite, I think, in many ways, of the ethics of the mental health of under capitalism. And no wonder it comes from feminist quarters, right? Mm-hmm. understandably, it had to come from there. And I think we have to more and more engage with these forms of engagement based on care. But again, care is difficult. Right? Care is difficult. It's not just about, oh, I care for you, and I, you know, as I hoped I've shown, I've explained it, especially in the analytic situation, but with people in general, care is not just let's hold hands and hug, and no, it's not. It's difficult. It involves many things that might not seem caring on the surface, but that are caring at another level. I'll stop there. I don't know if you have any questions about it, about what I'm saying.
I'm really fascinated about what you're talking about in terms of that stillness and that attention and the analytic love that you described. And, you know, I myself have gotten a lot of training in medical settings as a student. And so I'm trying to figure out how I can grow some of that attention and stillness that you're talking about in my work with patients. Sometimes I feel like I don't even know how to do that. So I'm wondering if you have any suggestions for how one might grow that.
That's a very good question. I think I was lucky to have a very good supervisor who taught me that. I think supervisors, teachers, people who practice it and make you feel safe that if you just are still and listening, you're doing lots. Mm. You see, in my experience, I have a supervisor I still see, we meet as colleagues now. And I remember years ago, it was a patient that I had who was very, again, all over the place, very scattered. Her life was very disorganized. She had just stopped drinking and taking drugs. But very scattered thinking, like thought process, but which was also reflected in her rather disorganized life and a lot of issues around taking care of herself, like mm-hmm. just simply, you know, eating, having a proper meal, sleeping well, etc. Right. So I start listening to her. And at the beginning, I was very excited because I was like, oh my God, this is free association. She's freely associating, blah, blah, blah. And there's a difference between free association and people who are just very scattered and they're just all over the place. It's not the same thing. We might talk about it. But my supervisor says, I don't think this is like free association. I think this is more her just like trying to find some meaning in what she was saying because she was so disorganized in her thought process, right? So she told me, just listen to her. And I was listening to her. And I would sometimes reflect back now, this or that, and she would... And again, at the beginning, I was like, I didn't know what the hell I was doing as a therapist, as I think most therapists, we don't know what we're doing, right? I think I was portraying the character of a therapist, basically, right? It felt a little bit inauthentic for me. But based on this idea of being a therapist was that I had to, and people have, that you have to say something, ask questions, give interpretations. You have to be very active, right? And that's how it's shown on TV, right? In general, in media, right? Because if you show a real psychoanalytic session on TV, it would be super boring, right? All the silences and it would be boring. And all these, you know, the important moments, there are sessions in which there are no, you know, eureka moments or like, no, I mean, most of the times it's not, right? People telling you about their day, you know, I went to the supermarket and blah, blah, blah. You know, it's simple, ordinary lives, right? But when you're involved, you're very interested, right? But from a spectator, they're like, well, this is not so interesting. But for you, it's very interesting. So going back to what I was saying, so we come with these ideas of what a therapist should do. So I told her name is Victoria. Victoria, I don't think I'm doing anything. And she would tell me, continue doing what you're doing, listen to her attentively. And she would make me write process notes of all the sessions. She did that for years. I have notebooks and notebooks of that. I've never taken notes during a session, but I would immediately afterwards try to write as much as I could remember. So everything. So I would read it to her and we would think about her, right? And then at the end of the first year of treatment, and I'm using the word treatment, and I'm trying to use it less and less.
Mm-hmm.
As I don't think analysis is a treatment. I don't like that language anymore. Because if I'm saying that it's without aim and all that, how is it a treatment? Well, I don't know. That's another problem. That's my problem. But see, at the year, she started to become much more organized in her thinking and in her life. Just by having me be there every week, listening to her attentively. The attention is important. Attentively.
Mm-hmm.
And talking about her with my supervisor and thinking about her. She knew that I was thinking about her. She knew that I was keeping her in mind, even though I wasn't telling her this, but patients perceive that.
Yeah.
And I was like, what happened here? I didn't do anything. And my supervisor told me, you did a lot and you're doing a lot. Because imagine somebody who's so disorganized, just to have somebody be a center of being attended to by somebody who's there still is organizing. You see, that's what happens with kids, right? With babies, for example, right? The babies, they start babies and then they start growing. They yell, they poop, they do a bunch of things. The parents, they see all of these different activities as belonging to one same center of activity, which is the baby, right? The baby who cries, the baby who go to sleep, who poops. Because the baby doesn't come with a form of doesn't have a self yet developed. They develop, the self that the baby develops, or the kid develops, is an internalization of how the other thinks about you as one organizing, of one as one center of activity. So I am the same person who cries, who is hungry, you see? Because I am thought of as that way. So the same happened with this patient, right? I am being thought by this person, by me, by the therapist, as one and the same person, even if I'm talking about a whole things that are a mess. And that experience was organizing for her.
Wow.
But I just had to be still. I was lucky to have that supervisor and made me trust the process. You are doing something. You are doing something.
Mm-hmm.
You see? The other thing that helps, I think, is to what I said before, and you can try it, or other people who are listening who are therapists, try to be not reactive. You see? Sometimes when you, I once wrote a little post that said something like, sometimes we ask questions or say something because we feel that we need to be therapists, or because something that the patient is saying is making us feel a little anxious. So we want to change the conversation, or we want to, you see? So sometimes it's more about us and less about the other. So try to sit when you have an impulse to ask a question, for example, or say something. To just sit with it for some minutes and say, where is this coming from? Do I really need to say this? I learned, sometimes I ask questions for which I already knew the answer. So why would I ask the question to begin with, right? or feel immediately this thing that I do less now. Depending on the patient. It's always patient dependent. But I would do it more not depending on the patient. It's like, oh, that must have been very hard or this or that. It's such a generic thing to say. But it's more for me to feel that I'm doing my job and to feel me to calm my anxiety, not the patient's anxiety. So I'm not saying that don't make an intervention like that. Sometimes it could be very helpful, right? But I was using it like too much, like all the time immediately something's suffering, the patient is crying or this, and then, oh, it seems like this seems very sad for you. And then you start learning that either the patient acquiesces and says yes, or that they say, no, I'm not sad. I'm super pissed off. And you take the tears as tears of sadness when they're tears of anger, right? Which is very common. Or it could be impotence or frustration, or it can be envy, or it could be a whole bunch of things. So don't feel that you have to react. When a patient, I mean, that's the nightmare of especially people who are beginning to be therapists. Mm-hmm. To have a patient ask you a question. What do I do with a question? I remember a long time ago, a patient asked me, he was having, years ago, he was with a girlfriend. The girlfriend wanted to have a baby. He wasn't that sure, so they had conflicts over it. So he was talking about it. And he started to feel that unless he knew that I had kids, then I wouldn't be understanding. So he asked the nightmare when you're beginning, do you have kids? And I was like, well, what do you ask the question? And he told me, why do therapists always get so anxious when they are asked questions? Mm-hmm. And I became like defensive, kind of like, I even thought like, oh no, I'm not feeling anxious. Maybe you are, or something like, of course I was feeling anxious. Mm-hmm. Of course. And now with time, you amaze yourself. Mm-hmm. I expect people to ask me questions. It doesn't make me anxious, really. I'm kind of like curious, like what am I gonna do now with this question? So again, take it with curiosity. That's, I think, it's part of the stillness, right? Instead of saying, oh, what do I do? The question is not what I do. Is take it in and say, interesting. Now, maybe not to the patient, but to yourself. Oh, this is curious. Where does this question come? Mm-hmm. Right? Don't feel that you have to answer. Or feel that there's many things you can do with the question. Including answering the question. Huh? I'm not excluding that possibility, okay? Mm-hmm. With some people, if you don't answer the question, they become so frustrated that the treatment can't continue. So it's a little bit, it gives you a little bit of a sense of where the patient is at personality-wise, right? Mm-hmm. So tell me. And then you might say, well, you know, it's like you're putting me on the corner. You know, it feels like, you know, you're really pushing me to give you an answer and kind of like notice the insistent element of it. And then they continue. And then if it gets into too much, I'll answer. Mm-hmm. You see, I've become more flexible that way. But first, non-reactive. Don't be automatic. You know, I always give this example that I heard from Shelley Bach, a psychoanalyst who's from Iptar. I really love him. I love his work. He's known for working with narcissistic patients. And he told the story of a patient who brought him a gift. And as you do as an analyst, you did back in the day, or many analysts would still do, you just said, no, I can't take the gift. Let's talk about it. The patient got so angry that he threw the gift out of the window. And he was on a building, and he could have killed somebody. And I remember Dr. Bach saying, you know, now I would have taken the gift. Mm-hmm. Knowing how the patient was deeply hurt by it, right? So again, mm-hmm. It's a case-by-case situation, but don't feel that you have to react. Just take it in first. and then see what feels all right. Another example, I guess when people hear this, examples are interesting. A patient that I saw the first session, she was telling me that she was very angry with her bosses all the time and very irritable. She had a lot of issues with her anger with people. And then she felt that she would get so angry, that she was going to get so angry at her job that they were gonna lay her off, right? Her job.
Mm-hmm.
And then the session ended, and I said, "Well, we'll continue talking more about it next week." And she wouldn't stand up. She says, "But tell me, what should I do if I get angry?" And I was like, "I wasn't expecting it. You see, that's the unexpected, right?" And I said, "Well, you know, we'll talk about it next week." And I tried, and I was like trying to stand up a little bit. 15 minutes, and it was already the next person was going to come. So what do you do? And I don't know where it came from. I'm not going to kick her out of the, but I need to see someone else. I said, "You'll hear someone else. We'll talk about it." And then I told her, I don't know where it came from. I told her, if you feel that you get so angry that you might lose your job, call me immediately. And she left. She didn't call me. But she needed to feel that she was connected to me through that period of time. I don't know where that came from in me. That I've never said that to any other patient ever. So that's the other thing. Don't feel that you have to say the same thing all the time.
Mm-hmm.
So think about it. And if you don't feel you can answer, you say, I need a little more time to answer. That's to me, okay. Why not? You know, I don't know if that helps.
That's helpful, yeah.
And then just have some sessions where you're just listening.
Mm-hmm.
You see, without feeling, I supervise people and then they tell me, "Carlos, I feel that I'm not doing anything." To talk about how the culture is right now, that we're not making any, I'm not helping the person. The person is not, the therapy is not working. Mm-hmm. And I said, "How long have you seen the patient?" 3 months. And I'm like, "Well, what did you expect? 3 months is nothing." But you see, for a certain mentality, or a certain form of treatment, that might be a lot. For psychoanalysis, 3 months, I'm just getting to know the person.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just listening. What can I say after 3 months? Nothing. I mean, it would just be a projection, my own projections, not really listening to the other person. Mm-hmm. So we have to have other, maybe what could help, to have another sense of time. I know that if we work in certain places, everything conspires against time. I know that. That's why I felt that the mental health system here is not, if we want to extend the Winnicottian term, it's not a holding environment for patients or for clinicians too. They don't let you do your job in a calm place, a space and with time. And then I bet you have to, I've seen sometimes like 50 patients in a clinic, and you're underpaid. And oh my God, how can you? You can't work that way. There's no time, and then there's no time. There's no mental space. Remember the Simone Weil, right? The stillness, mm-hmm. and then the emptiness to let the patient begin to inhabit you. There is no mental space for that if you're constantly worried about if you have 50 patients, underpaid, etc. It's the whole system that's pardon my French, fucked up.
Mm-hmm.
Fucked up totally. I have no doubt about it. More and more convinced about it. And that's why I think that we people have to take more initiatives in doing. I've been meeting with people who are you know, who want, we need more therapists to be brave, not only be activists in fixing and changing policies and everything, but also taking the chance of working, you know, doing groups and creating groups to work with people. And I don't know, it needs to be a movement of therapists, because I know that it's not only me who's thinking this way. There's many other people who feel that way, you see? But we need to feel the system needs to hold us in some way so we can do our work it and feel safe and have time and mental space. If we don't have mental space, we can't take the patient in. It's impossible. We can't think about the patient. We can't, it's very, very challenging.
Mm-hmm.
You see? So, but try it. I mean, and don't feel that, okay, 3 months, maybe, I don't know, maybe your supervisors are putting pressure on you or your boss or something. And it sucks. I know. That's the reality of it. I worked that way and I got burned out totally. Totally burned out.
Yeah.
It's you take too much in. You can do manualistic forms of treatment. You can do other treatment, breathing exercises. Some therapists are there to chat with the patient. Oh, how was your weekend? But not real therapy. You can see 50 patients like that. But if you are engaged in this way that I'm talking about, it's a lot. It's a lot. So, I mean, that's the, what Scott Graybaugh talks, also the austerity aspect of living under capitalism, right? That it's, everything has to be austere in the sense of, you know, the patient coming has to be 12 sessions, super fast, and then you're out, right? Because nobody was going to want to pay, there's no money for a long term, something that takes time. Something that, and that hence needs, you know, you need to put money into it. And if we if we talk about COVID nowadays, I'm worried about what's going to happen with people in some years. We're already suffering it, right?
Mm-hmm.
But what's going to happen once we come out, right? I bet there is going to be a mental health problem. I'm sure.
Absolutely.
I'm sure. And what are we going to do as therapists? It's going to be a problem. I'm fearing that. In adolescents, I see adolescents. They're having a very hard time. In kids, children. Those are the people who are you're going to see.
Yeah.
Well, I hope I'll see them too. I'll be alive. But you're going to be seeing that. But we lived it, so we know you're gonna see it. It's gonna come out in some form or the other. This isolation, this frustration, this sense of like no future, alteration, the radical alteration of our normal, ordinary lives, the deaths, the feeling of helplessness, especially you know the poorer people, and you know. People of color too, the sense that, and I'll shut up here, that there's no care.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody cares.
Yeah.
Nobody cares. That's terrible. That's traumatic. It's traumatic. Totally. Mm-hmm. The feeling that nobody cares for you.
Carlos, yeah, I think that's a really, really important point, and it really brings us back to the topic of today's talk about the ethics of care and the ethics of what we actually do with our patients. And I really want to thank you for talking with us today, and I'm so glad you were able to come back and talk mm-hmm. to us again on the podcast.
No, thanks for having me. You get me started with some topics and I start talking. I always say I like to talk, but I think I always like to talk, but I think that I spend so much time in silence.
Yeah, yeah.
That when they ask me to talk, I come with a revenge.
Well, I think we're probably going to ask you to come back again. So just be prepared for that.
But I hope you didn't feel like I was like, you couldn't like speak or something. Okay. No. Okay. No.
And you know what? This is actually good practice for me in being still and paying attention, something that I have a hard time with. So.
You know, something up to end, something that, I'm also, I tend to be very impatient. And through my life, I can say, being an analyst has helped me, has been an exercise in patience. And, you know, always analysts are going to say, if only patients knew how much I've changed and learned, which is true, absolutely true. It's been a lesson in patience and in stillness. And you'll see that with time, you're going to, it's going to come naturally. I also some time ago started, then I stopped, but I did yoga too. That was also an exercise in stillness, to be still there with yourself. So there are exercises, I think. But you have to be, it's not easy. Nowadays, it's difficult to be still, right? Maybe now, you know, people who had the luck to stay, I'm one of the lucky ones, I'm privileged that way. I could continue because many people had to just continue working outside, you know. I could stay here, you know, working from home. And, you know, some for some people who could stay at home, it's been an exercise in stillness, I think. I've heard that from several people. For other people, it's been like the worst thing that has happened to them. But some people have flourished. That's interesting, too. And they said, oh, my God, now I know I can be still and just be with myself and, you know, and be with those people around me and not feel that I have to do something.
Yeah.
I think that's the trick. Don't feel that you have to do something. See, sometimes doing something gets in the way of actually doing something or helping somebody.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, if nothing else, this pandemic has shown me just how desperate I am sometimes to be doing something. And, you know, I don't think I've flourished in this time. I think I've really struggled, but I think at least it has lifted the veil for me on just how busy my mind is and how much I want to be doing things all the time. So in that way, it's been helpful for me.
No, I've struggled too. It's been a struggle for me, without a doubt. Some people, I think, have flourished. I mean, there would be something interesting to study, right? Those who flourish and those who feel like, I just want to go out and you know, and run and be with people. I'm ready for that.
Yep.
But thanks for having me. I'm always I'm glad to be here and a big supporter of your podcast.
Thank you so much, Carlos. Thank you.